My guest at this time is Ashley McGuire. She's a senior fellow at the Catholic Association and author of the brand new book, Sex Scandal: The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. The book closely examines the effort to blur the lines between the sexes and the consequences of doing so. And Ashley, thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, the conventional wisdom, if you pay attention to most of the mainstream media and so forth, is that the transgender movement is about accommodating the very small percentage of people who sincerely believe they are a different sex than their anatomy would suggest. But you believe there's much more to this movement. What do you think is the real end game here?
Well, as I point out in my book, I think that the movement is actually a lot broader than we think. And what I try to do in my book is bring all these different threads together of ways in society that we're denying that the sexes are different, or at least trying to obliterate those differences. So I think it starts really young with children, and you see examples of this. You know, stories seem totally crazy until they come to your own school. Your own kids' school. Stories like teachers banning Legos because the boys are more likely to play with the Legos than the girls. High schools where you're not allowed to say homecoming king or queen, you have to say home court royals because you might offend somebody just using the words king or queen. And I think it goes through college and all the way into adulthood. And I think the end game here is being pushed by an elite segment of society that thinks that equality only will come when we all seem truly identical, or when we liberate ourselves, quote unquote, from this idea of sex and gender.
Why is this burst onto the scene so quickly? Is it just piggybacking on the Supreme Court ruling on gay marriage, or is there another reason for the urgency here?
You know, one of the things I do in my book is show that I think it's actually been unfolding very slowly since the sexual revolution. And I think, you know, for a lot of people, suddenly they're waking up and feeling like this feels really extreme, like it's moving really quickly. You know, another example I gave is suddenly we're talking about drafting women into the military. Like, how did we get to this point? In my book, I argue that I think this all started with the sexual revolution, which was this idea that anything goes with sex, but specifically that radical left-wing feminists pushed this idea that we're very gendered, that we've been socialized to be a certain way, that these are superficial things, and that sex is actually something very random, that we just need to get ourselves out of this male-female boxes for women to be equal with men. And we're just starting to see some of the most extreme manifestations of it now, you know, a few decades later.
We'll talk about some of the evidence a little bit later in our conversation. But as you just pointed out, Ashley, you argue in this book that the same feminists who championed the sexual revolution and other liberal causes for decades are now advocating for a movement that you point out in the book actually hurts women, from injecting biological males into women's sports to a major push, as you just mentioned, to make women eligible to be drafted into the military someday, to making them more vulnerable to sexual assault. So whether it's education, whether it's military service, is there any particular area, safety on college campus, that you think is most urgent right now when it comes to how this is emerging as a threat actually to women?
I would say there's two really standout examples. One is relates to the military. And I think, you know, everybody prayed. There was a lot of praise when the military came out and said, we're going to open all combat roles to women. Everybody said, finally, everybody's equal in the military. What they didn't talk about was the fact that now, if you're a woman in the military and the military decides it's going to send you into combat, you don't have a choice. So let's say you enlisted in the military 10, 15 years ago, and you happen to be a very strong woman. You would be sent to the front lines and have absolutely no choice about this. And the Secretary of Defense confirmed this in a press conference when he was asked about it. And then secondly, this idea of conscripting women into the military seems completely insane to me. And by the way, violates one of the most important tenets of left-wing feminism, which is choice. And it's ironic to me that we're suddenly actually talking about taking away choice from women, choice as to whether or not they're going to be put into some of the most dangerous situations possible. And then you look at, for example, the Marines just had their boot camp go co-ed, and now they're actually going to be putting men and women into the same sleeping quarters. So, I mean, that raises all sorts of risks for sexual assault, lawsuits, rape, things like that. The second example, I think, are college campuses. You know, I cite a study in my book that talks about, I think it's something like 80% of rapes happen in college dorms, and a very small percent happen, a lot smaller than you would think, happen in fraternities and sororities or off-campus housing. And that shouldn't surprise us because most of these dorms are actually co-ed. The idea being that, you know, men and women are no different. We can put them in the same building where they're going to sleep and shower, and often they're showering and bathing in the same bathroom. And now you have colleges actually talking about, and some of them are already implementing this, co-ed dorm rooms, but at the same time wondering why it is that women are being raped left and right.
What's the reaction from feminists or other activists on this issue when these sorts of things are pointed out to them?
Well, interestingly, when it comes to really left-wing feminists, there's actually a contingency that are lining up alongside social conservatives, raising concern about the gender identity movement. I'll give the example of Harvard University. Harvard University went and tried to ban single-sex housing, and they did it, in their words, to protect women. And they were taken aback when it was women who protested the most and said, "You're taking away our safe spaces." And they had a hashtag campaign. They protested on campus for a week. So there actually is some outrage on both sides, I think, because people, women especially, are realizing that when you deny these categorical differences between the sexes and specifically try to stamp them out, it's women who are going to be hurt the most.
So you've got some unlikely allies, which I'm sure gives comfort to both sides of the political and cultural spectrum. But what about the big mainstream push here? What answers do you get from those who are actually advocating for this when you point out some of these things that are actually detrimental to women? How do they defend it?
I think they try to basically stifle out any sort of dissent on the issue. And, you know, I think there's actually very few people who are speaking out against it. I think because up until recently, for the most part, this all seemed like something that didn't affect people in a very personal way. But increasingly, I think people are starting to see whether it's, you know, somebody like me, a mother to a couple of young children, faced with the prospect that, you know, my kids might be taught in their school curriculum as young as kindergarten, stuff about gender and, you know, gender being a malleable construct. So I think, you know, there's definitely that.
Well, let's talk about a couple aspects, and you led right into one of them, and that is, what advice do you have for parents, particularly parents of young kids? Maybe it's high school students. Who knows how the kids are going to encounter this or be affected by this? So with the culture clearly pushing in one direction, what do you say to parents who are trying to hold their ground?
Well, I think the most important thing parents can do is listen to their instincts, not the culture. So I give the example of Target, which recently, I think under a lot of pressure, decided they were going to stop, you know, selling toys based on gender. I forget the language that they use. And there's even been, you know, now they're being pressured to stop selling clothing based on, you know, categorizing clothing based on boy or girl. But interestingly, one thing I cite in the book is Lego as an interesting case study. You know, you have some places where, you know, I give the example of one teacher banning it in her classroom for quote-unquote gender equity reasons. But then Lego came out with its own line of Legos for girls, and it quickly became one of their best-selling lines of Legos ever. So I think that to the extent that parents can, one, shield their children from this, opt them out of courses, and many of these courses are optional sex ed courses where they're being taught lunacy at second and third grade, opt them out and let them be themselves. And by the way, that doesn't always, you know, there's plenty of examples of, you know, girls who are tomboys, boys who are interested in the kitchenette, and that's okay too, but don't, I mean, I think what we're seeing now is society actually actively encouraging confusion. And that's the kind of thing parents have to resist, whether it's, you know, whether they're getting it in their consumer choices or whether it's actually being taught in their schools. I think being alert to what's being taught to their kids, but also keeping at a distance all of this idea that, you know, toys and clothes have to be gender neutral or else you're doing some sort of harm to your children is completely false.
And jumping off on the tomboy side of things, is there a lot of pressure when kids tend to stray away from what are traditional gender norms for the folks in this movement to try and say that that's who they are, whether they're five or seven, and well before they've actually kind of figured out who they are?
Oh, yeah. In fact, I give the example in my book of a school that hosted something called Gender Bender Day, where kids were encouraged to dress up as the opposite sex. I mean, is there a time when something like that might have been harmless? Yes. But, you know, in today's society, we all know that that's not just like a harmless wacky hair day on par with wacky hair day. That's actually, there's always assume there's some sort of political agenda behind anything that has to do with sex and gender in your kid's school.
You also point out in the book, men and women are different. That shouldn't be a newsflash, but to some folks, it is. You say there's even more startling evidence that men and women are even more different than previously thought. Explain what you discovered.
Well, absolutely. I think what's so interesting is that at the same time that our society is increasingly denying the difference between the sexes, we're coming out with more and more evidence of just how different they are. But not just that, but how much those differences matter and how they contribute, how we contribute to each other in complementary ways. So one of the examples that I give is the workplace. More and more studies are coming out that find that men and women have a very different approach to the workplace, that they bring different sets of skills to the table, and that those are good things. And that, you know, when you bring more women into the workplace, you know, one of the things I found that I thought was fascinating was that men who become fathers to little girls end up giving their employees a pay raise. That there's something about even just being exposed to women that makes men want to be more just CEOs, things like that. And I think that's the direction that we should be going in, that we should be exploring what our differences are, how our differences contribute in mutually beneficial ways, and trying to establish an equality that's based on that, not on this fake and unrealistic idea that if we make everything identical, that's when we'll have achieved equality.
Ashley, last question is on the PR pushback or a concerted pushback to what is a very aggressive movement, as we've discussed. You're clearly doing your part with the book and interviews such as this. What do you see in the big picture, though? I mean, we see the pro-life movement pushing back against pro-choice. Oh. We saw an active movement defending traditional marriage and so forth. What does it look like on this front?
I think so. I think it's starting to gather, and I think a lot of it is right now being organized by parents. You know, you see when these schools do try to totally overhaul their curriculum, you see, you know, parents being the ones organizing and turning out in huge numbers to protest that. But what I do find interesting, and I mentioned this a bit earlier, is that, for example, I was just invited to an event of women, both social conservatives and left-wing feminists, organizing against this as well. So I think we may see some strange bedfellows as this, you know, the patchwork begins to come together, because there's so many different people in different facets who are affected by this. But I wouldn't be surprised if, much like the pro-life movement, the response to this one is also woman-led as well. Because, as I said, women are the ones who lose in a world where it's scandalous to even use the word woman as a category.
Amazing. Ashley, congratulations on the book. Thank you very much for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Ashley McGuire is senior fellow at the Catholic Association. Her new book is Sex Scandal, The Drive to Abolish Male and Female. I'm Greg Corumbus, reporting for Radio America.